Good morning, everyone. My name is Dave Markowitz at Stanford University, and on behalf of my collaborators, Jeff Hancock and Jamie Pennebaker, who's at UT Austin, I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today about a topic that I find absolutely fascinating. Hope you will as well. So the relationship between deception and language, but I'm going to be taking a theoretical perspective today to try to understand how context may influence the way that deception affects language. I think a lot of the sessions that we've had so far are really great to understand, well, context may be your moderator here, or context matters. But what's really interesting for me is, what is context? It's an ill-defined term. It's this sort of frothy elephant in the room to understand what we mean by context, independent, when we talk about communication, independent from deception, and then the combination of the two. So this is nothing new to anyone here in this room. The way that we sort of study deception is that we observe it in the wild, or we observe it in an experimental setting, and then it's associated with some change here, delta, in human behavior, and I'm conceptualizing this as language use. And if we take a cue-based approach to understanding how deception affects language here, we find a variety of mixed findings. I'm going to go through 8 total studies, about a sentence or two each, of how deception actually affects language, and we find mixed evidence for the effect here. When people are told to lie or tell the truth about their ideas on abortion, or when they have to lie or tell the truth about their attitudes towards their friends, they use fewer first-person singular pronouns. These are words such as I, me, or my, and they suggest the psychological attachment that a person has to their experience. This is a psychological distancing mechanism. It's very stressful or distressing for people to lie, especially when they're talking about such sensitive topics. So they tend to increase the distance from the self to that deception by using fewer first-person singulars. Now, this holds, this pattern, when we look at computer-mediated communication, when people have to interact on instant message chat. This is actually borrowing some of Judy's paradigms from a 2001 paper. And this very similar psychological distancing effect is found when we look in this example. Now, when we look opposite, the effect is still significant, but in the opposite direction here when we look at political deception. When we look at President Bill Clinton and the Monica Lewinsky affair, and Richard Nixon and Watergate, they actually featured more first-person singular when they're lying relative to when they're telling the truth about the event. Then fake hotel opinion spam. So TripAdvisor was used as a window to understand how fake online reviews are written compared to truthful reviews. There are more first-person singular in the fake reviews relative to the truthful ones. Now, this may suggest what's with first-person singular. Perhaps it's not that important of a cue, but a lot of social and psychological literature suggests that it's really important to understand how we really think and feel about a particular experience. So let's press on to something else that really matters, and a lot of things that we've really been discussing before. Negative emotion terms. These are words such as hate, dislike, or terror. And one of the things that was a really slick study in 2012 was that people entered into the lab, and their height, weight, and age were taken, and they were then measured against their online dating profile. So how people, if they were 5'10", but really they're 5'7", in real life, any discrepancy between that was deemed an untruth or a deception. And then there was a negative association with the events in real life to negative emotion terms. So any more deception in real life was then negatively associated with negative emotion terms. So that typically goes against what this leakage idea from Paul Ekman and a lot of things that Mark Frank was discussing yesterday. So we have this inconsistency. A really great study from Burns and Moffitt where they have adjudicated 911 calls. So when 911 is called and the operator picks up, sometimes there's false evidence for why a call is made, and sometimes there's truthful evidence. The liars, the one where there's false evidence, actually contain fewer negative emotion terms. As we've heard with reality monitoring, it's very difficult for liars to simulate that psychological experience and simulate the details that they have about their event because they're not telling the truth about that experience. The opposite effect here in a Zhao et al. Paper where they look at either in a sender or a receiver role when they're emailing back and forth to people about a variety of different topics. They use more negative emotion terms when they're lying, and a consistent effect is found when people have to lie or tell the truth about their musical tastes. 8 studies across 2 different cues, we find a variety of different mixed findings. So how do we interpret these findings? I pose this question because there's a suggestion that there may be more to a deception than just the act of misleading. So perhaps if we try to interpret this question, there are two possibilities. The first one is a pessimistic view, I guess, of what we've been proposing here. Deception actually may not affect language, and we're just picking up on randomness. It's a possibility. Variety of studies may suggest that's not the case, but what I'd like to propose today and to suggest to you all is that deception does affect language, but it's not uniform. And I think to some of all of us, to some degree, would agree with this. If you want to substitute language for another dependent variable, we would agree that there's something about the situation, what I'm going to argue, context, that really influences the way that deception affects language. But the key for me is, what is context? And a lot of this has been answered empirically. The basis to understand what context may mean or how we can empirically suggest that context matters comes from a 2014 meta-analysis where there are 44 studies overviewed, all using computerized text analysis methods to get at the relationship between deception and language. They found relatively, as many meta-analyses have found, small to either null effects for the way that deception affects language. However, they accounted for 5 moderators, really suggesting that there's something else going on about the situation, about the deception, that really matters. The moderators were accounted for the event type. Was it a first-person experience, or is it an attitude or a liking paradigm where you have to say you like something, say you don't like something, or lie and tell the truth about that? The emotional valence of the situation, was it negative to begin with? And that's why the negative emotion terms pop, so that is something we need to consider. The interaction type, was there no interaction? Was it an interview, as we've seen with a lot of the police interviews? The motivation, were there any incentives for deception? And the production mode, so was it written, spoken, or typed? All of these really shifted and nudged and sometimes even changed the direction of the effect in that meta-analysis, suggesting again there's something else going on here for the somewhat simple relationship between deception and language. Is actually more complex than that. So for me, this empirical suggestion that context really matters is something that needs to be drilled down even further. So I'm a communication scholar. I look to the communication literature to see what do people say about communication and language being a context-contingent phenomenon aside when we put aside deception. We're not even thinking about deception yet. We're just talking about how is language context contingent. I look at a 1980 paper from Applegate and Delia that really suggests there are 5 types of setting that when combined form a context. So the physical setting, so where you're located, the social and relational setting. So these are things, every single relationship that we have these intricacies and these various details that are only specific to that interaction. When we change our social interactions, those intimacies and those dynamics change. The institutional setting, so are you at work, are you at school, are you at a business? The functional setting, what are you trying to achieve with the Communication Act? And finally, the cultural setting. And one thing that I also add here from Mark Knapp in a really great book chapter in 2002 is the message-related setting. We write emails differently than we tweet, than we write Facebook messages, than we text message. So all of the different language features that we have are inherently constrained by the type of communication medium that we're using. So to keep that in mind, that's when we think about communication as a context-contingent phenomenon, independent of deception. But now let's see what deception scholars actually say about how deception is context-dependent. A variety of deception theories, ranging from interpersonal deception theory, have a say about what context really means for deception. But a very recent piece, specifically truth default theory, suggests that taking content in context can help to inform us about how to either detect or to understand deception. Actually, a piece in 2010 by Blair et al. Really is one of the first ones to suggest this idea. And truth default theory suggests that there are 3 ways that taking this content in context can really inform us. You can offer contradictions, normative information about the situation, and finally, idiosyncrasies. And the thing that I really like to highlight here is this normative information. Douglas Biber has a really great phrase that we have this idea about a genre. And a genre is a discourse community. So academics, and we all form a discourse community versus those talking about athletics form a discourse community. Those who talk about music form a discourse community. We are all constrained by the type of community we are situated in. So this normative information is really important to highlight what may or may not be affected by deception. So just to quickly summarize this, sort of the motivations for understanding what context means, first we find the empirical backing. We find that this how should all meta-analysis really suggests there's something else going on here about deception or about the way that deception affects language. Then we look at the variety of ways that communication is context dependent. And then we find that this normative information or taking the situation and the constraints of the situation into account are really important. So with that, one of the contributions that I think I'd like to leave you with is what's called CDEL, or the working title of Context, Deception, and Language. It's a framework to really understand what are the various features that may be important for looking at the relationship between deception and language. Not maybe even specific to language, just thinking about deception as being this context contingent phenomenon. So there are three prongs, the first being psychological dynamics, and I'm going to drill down to all of these soon. Psychological dynamics, pragmatic goals, and then genre conventions. So the first one, I'm not going to beat a dead horse here. We've gone through this many times so far about what are the emotional and cognitive effects that deception has on human behavior, but specifically to language, what may it mean? So it's how we respond emotionally, how we respond cognitively, but when we think about if we take this cue approach, what is important here. So the Burns and Moffitt piece from 2014, where they looked at the adjudicated 911 calls, really was an inspiration for me to go forth with this, where negative emotion terms, you would think, especially in a very problematic or distressing situation, where you're calling 911 for a specific reason, the liars had a very difficult time simulating that negative experience. They used fewer negative emotion terms compared to the truth tellers. So there's something emotionally going on. It's not always this leakage idea. It's not either if positive emotion terms were to really pop, it wouldn't be this duping delight idea. But taking every single situation as its own, understanding the intricacies of the emotional experience and the cognitive experience is something that is really necessary moving forward. And cognitively, we could look at a variety of different cues if it's important for the understanding that respect. Looking at the structure and the brevity of the discourse, either readability, understanding a variety of different metrics to really get at what happens when deception affects language. Now, the second part here of the CDEL, as I've labeled it, is what is the liar trying to accomplish by their act of deception, and then how is that reflected linguistically? And I'd like to get a little bit of audience participation here. I have two statements. I'm going to like to see which one, or they're, of the options, which one you believe to be deceptive. These are online dating ads or sort of statements from online dating profiles. I admit it, I was on the verge of slapping a hipster today, so I moved out of Williamsburg. Williamsburg, for those who don't know, is kind of like a swanky area of New York City. And the second one is, I hate Williamsburg, put me out of my misery or get me back to California ASAP. Please raise your hand if you believe the first one is deceptive. Kind of difficult, you're not really given much. First one is deceptive, I'll guess about a third of you. The second one, all right, the second one takes it, but the first one's actually deceptive. So we're not even great lie detectors even if we study deception. So if we think about the goals of an online dater, what are you trying to do if you're putting yourself out there as someone who's looking for a date? The goal is to obviously find someone that you can spend the rest of your life with, potentially, but you're trying to put your best face and your best text forward. So to do that, you may not, or a way to do that is to not use negativity or anything that could be problematic for your online dating profile and trying to find a mate. So as I said before, there are a variety of motivations for why people may deceive. Some of them all come all the way from a 1975 paper ranging to saving face, to exert power over another person. So we have these goals, and these goals are not uniform. So if we don't have uniform goals for this deception, why should language then be uniformly constructed as a result of deception? So these relate, just to tie a lot of this together, these relate to a lot of the ways that communication is context-dependent, relating to the functional and the functional setting in addition to the social and the relational setting. Now, the final prong of the CDEL, the model, the framework that I'm proposing here, deals with genre conventions, taking a lot of inspiration from truth-default theory, when it's talked about the normative conventions for a discourse community in addition to the message-related setting. And a lot of this work really was inspired by some of the things that I've done with Jeff on scientific fraud, really understanding or posing this high-level question of, when scientists fake data, do they write their research reports differently than when they actually produce genuine data? We had a piece on Diedrich Stoppel that was in PLOS One, and another one that's coming out soon, really looking at, is there the ability to understand the way that people deceive in science? But when we relate this to genre conventions, if you remember, one of the first things that I showed you was first-person singular pronouns and the way that they operate when we look at how deception affects first-person. Now, you'd think, are we going to evaluate first-person singular in science fraud? The answer to me, if we're taking a context-contingent outlook here, would be no. And the reason for that is because it's a non-convention. It's atypical for people to even use, even if it's a single-author paper, it's atypical for people to use first-person singular. So taking this context-constrained approach, taking all this together, we really find, even an example here where I have a variety of different pronouns, you don't find first-person really popping. And this, I don't expect anyone to really understand some of the text here. These are from a lot of biomedical science articles, but we don't find first-person. So some of the observations here and some of the things that with any sort of framework or any sort of idea that maybe we're looking for feedback on, looking at some of the limitations or observations here. How do you account for multiple goals? How do you account for multiple modes of communication or quickly changing modes of communication? Is really, it's a more of a methodological issue and also a conceptual one. How do we really define when a goal is present or when one starts or when one ends? And one thing that I'm really working with Jamie on is to understand how we can use big data to define context. And I'll explain what this really means. If we were to propose the sort of conventional way that we understand deception in language is that you have this between subjects idea where you take a variety of lies, you take a variety of truths, and you compare the two. But is it possible that some of these lies and truths don't differ from the discourse community in general? So using advantages of computational social science, we can get at massive amounts of data to define context linguistically. So here, if we have a third bar, and this is some of the takeaways potentially of how we can maybe construct studies in the future, if we define context, and I'm using this red bar here as massive amounts of language data of the type of community that's being referred to, and then see if there's a comparison and a difference between lies and the context, if there's a difference between truths and the context, and then overall lies and truths. So thinking about this in more of a 30,000 foot view and then drilling down to some of these specifics may be a more strategic approach for understanding how deception affects language. Now I began with this sort of very simple linear relationship where we observe a deception, it leads to some associative change. I think it's more complex than that. I think hopefully one of the takeaways has been that it's more complex. We need to understand that there is this change in human behavior. There is this change in language use. But there are these elements of context that may operate in the periphery in addition to directly affecting and nudging the effect that deception has on language. I'd like to thank you, and I welcome your questions.